Ahoy, Vachon. How's the French say, Vachon? This is the Brown Briefly, where less is more, more or less, coming to you live over KVSH 101.9 FM, Voice of Vachon, your island connection. Please make us part of your day. And be advised that our assertions and views, which can modestly be described as progressive persuasion, do not in any way reflect the opinions of KVSH or Voice of Vachon.
All right, that was the voice of Brian Brown, creator of the Brown Briefly. Every week we try to live up to his high standards of hosting a discussion of current events laced with empathy, intelligence, humor, and progressive persuasion. Brian's concept of less is more, more or less, always left us wanting more. Except for that background sound I just heard a little bit up there a minute ago. I don't know if that made it across or not. Did you hear that, Bruce, Micah, or Kevin? No? Oh, okay.
I have to admit, that was me. I'm here on arraignment watch service to the Brown Briefly listeners, just in case anything, you know, pops up of interest, we can make sure that they hear about it so they can pay full attention to our Brown Briefly and guests today.
Well, good multitasking there, Kevin. I appreciate that very much. Let's jump right in with our friends old and new. Unfortunately, we do not have our friend Truman O'Brien with us today. Truman just got back from a trip to New York City with his wife, and I'm not saying anything that's secret. He had posted this on Facebook about an hour ago. He has come down with a case of COVID. So we are wishing Truman the best and a speedy recovery. So I'm manning the board. So if everything goes sideways, you get to blame me. We're also joined via Zoom by the defender of democracy, Kevin Jones of Indivisible Vachon and the Vachon Climate Action Group, who collectively strive to create a livable planet overseen by a government we can all appreciate. Or at least tolerate. How are you, Kevin?
I'm doing well. I'm bringing a good deal of tolerance to my day today, having spent a little bit of time on Fox News, checking out how things are going from the other side of the world. Otherwise doing good.
Good, good. We'll be waiting for your reports toward the end of the show. Zooming in from home and still inhabiting the northern and western hemispheres, historian extraordinaire, skipper of the Vachona, president of the Vachon Heritage Museum, and our own globetrotting guardian of the galaxy, Bruce Holman, is here. How are you doing, Bruce?
I'm doing well. I'm still waiting for spring to make its appearance. I hear there's rumors that it may come sometime next week, but I haven't seen it yet. So
we keep getting head
fakes.
Wearing
my fleeces.
Yeah, that's right. We do. We keep getting head fakes, I think, with regards to spring.
Exactly.
Okay. This week, our special small talk guest is Marcy Summers, director and co-founder of the Alliance for Tampatika Conservation, to discuss healing the relationship between people and the rest of nature, starting on Indonesia's island of Sulawesi. Welcome back, Marcy. How are you?
Thank you. Very delighted to be here.
We're glad to have you here and interested to hear about what this organization, the ALTO organization, does, and how it relates to Vachon. We'll talk about that in just a moment. Mine is the voice of Craig Bellis, former repo man, Pinkerton guardian of Pan American's first 747, high fashion shoe salesman. That's high fashion shoe, not salesman. We have to get our adjectives straight there.
Thanks for clarifying.
Constitutional law professor and two-time, as my kids call me, half-bright scholar. As opposed to Fulbright scholar. Let's pause for a moment and take a little more time just to hear what you've been up to over the last week. Kevin, will you want to tell us? Aside from being on indictment watch?
Well, you know, indictment watch is captivating a lot of my attention right now. The home projects are coming along. The temperatures are warming up now, so I don't have to bring items into the house to paint them, so that's an encouraging sign of spring. in addition to pruning the apple trees, and the daffodils are starting to spring up. The lots of flower cuttings in the house from the forsythia. So it's looking very cheery here. And the Douglas squirrels are making their, and the chipmunks have now emerged from their overwintering. And they're making a great show out on the deck underneath the bird feeders where they like to congregate.
That all sounds so delightful. Hopefully, pretty soon we'll see the cherry blossoms. With that, Bruce, yes. How about you?
Well, I've been, museum is working on a really fascinating project. We're going to do a small special exhibit in July to correspond with Strawberry Festival on the Vashon Queen's Miss Vashon contest that started in 1923 and ran through 1972 on Vashon. So, and then was replaced by the Honorary Mayor contest because it began as a sort of fundraiser for community groups or communities on the island. So it's been fascinating meeting these folks who are all of our age now, who were Miss Vashon in the 1950s and 60s and 70s, and sort of navigating, if you will, that sort of delicate ground between 1950s and 60s sensibilities about festival queens and the homecoming queens and that kind of stuff, and modern feminist sensibilities, and trying to sort of bridge that, if you will. So been fascinating, and it'll be a great little exhibit.
You're the man for tiptoeing that tightrope, Bruce. Good work.
In my galoshes, right?
That's right. That does sound fascinating. I'm looking forward to hearing more about that. Mm-hmm. Marcy Summers, how about you? How has your last week been?
Well, my last week was kind of mixed. I've had some pretty intense things going on in my family. It's been death anniversaries of parents and things like that. And we also had to sell our ancestral family home on Bainbridge Island, and that happened this week. So there was a lot of very intense things going on. And to deal with that, I spent a lot of time trying to think up good April Fool's jokes. So
did you get anybody?
I sort of.
You don't want to share that.
Well, I had a good one with my daughter, but she was a little bit prepared.
She knows mom does that to her.
Yeah. So it was difficult, and but I still had just as much fun. So.
That's good. It's all in the joking.
Right.
Kevin. Go ahead, Kevin.
I'll have to say I did hear a good April Fool's story when I was out to dinner on Saturday. And it had to do with this, apparently a news story that to ease transportation back and forth to Vashon, a new idea was now to dig a tunnel underneath Puget Sound. And apparently the teller of the story had people pretty much going for thinking it was real until the end, which was the last line was April Fool's.
You know, that's a story that has been told off and on now for about 30 years. I remember telling that story and saying that we're going to put in one of those vacuum tubes. So that way you can't get a crowd of people here. They have to come across like one at a time with an elevator that can only carry one person going up where you get out of the tube. Bruce.
Interestingly enough, there's some truth in that. In the early 1950s, when the State Department of Transportation had these grandiose plans to build five bridges across Puget Sound, they just had completed the Tacoma Narrows Bridge after it had fallen down in 1940. They rebuilt it after the war, and there was going to be a bridge at Vashon. There was going to be a bridge at the north end of Bainbridge Island. There was going to be a bridge at Mukilteo Apple Tree Cove, and there was going to be a bridge at Port Townsend. And so there would be five bridges to bring people across the sound. And as part of that was one alternative was to have to dig tunnels, basically, under the sound. So there is a core of truth in that. So laugh as we may, those plans are still sitting in the State Department of Transportation. So never know when they're going to be resuscitated, right?
Controlling nature is something that... that I guess we've been trying to do for hundreds of years, sometimes to our chagrin. Mm-hmm. Today, I want to just mention, what did I do this last week? Oh, I saw the Rainbow Girls and Alessandra Rose at the theater, the Deborah Heege production. That was really good. I've seen them a few times, and I enjoy the production. And the acoustics at our theater, this is at the movie theater, are really quite excellent. So I enjoyed that. And then I'm getting ready for this Thursday morning scramble that I'm doing, dedicating it all to Willie Nelson, whose birthday is this month. He will be 90 years old.
Wow.
Trying to figure out how I'm going to leave my estate to him, because he's going to outlive us all.
It should be the other way around.
Yeah, it should, but it won't. I'm not sure it will be. Today in history. This is Tuesday, April 4th. It's the 94th day of the year. 271 days remain until the end of the year. And there are 101 days left before we reach the warm, sunny days of Strawberry Festival on July 14th. It's also, unfortunately, in 1968, the day that Martin Luther King, leader of the American Civil Rights Movement, was in Memphis to support a strike of city sanitation workers and was assassinated by James Earl Ray. But it is also the birthday in 1928 of Maya Angelou. She was born on this day. Another interesting fact that got me was in 1850, this is basically a year and a half after the gold rush began, after Sutter's Fort, where they found gold, Los Angeles was incorporated as a city with a population of 1,610 people. Mm-hmm. They've come a ways. In 1955, when Disneyland opened up, they had 5 million people. And in 2023, today, they have over 12.5 million people. So things have moved along at quite the pace. In 1949, NATO was founded on this day. And as many of you know, today, Finland joined NATO. So it's historical in both regards. Today is National Sexual Assault Awareness Day, National School Librarian Day, National Tell-A-Lie Day. That shouldn't be hard for some of us. National Walk-Around Things Day. Walk-Around Things Day? I'm not sure about that one. And if you have trouble seeing yourself celebrating any of those days, perhaps you need to focus on International Carrot Day. And it's also predicted that today will be a very stormy day. Pun intended. Kevin.
Yes, I do want to reflect on that National Walk Around Things Day. Susie and I spent some time visiting my sister when she was living in New Orleans. And we went out to a venue there, sat by a window right on Bourbon Street. And we saw some people who were not able to walk around things, actually. One person in particular in a telephone pole were notable. Walking around things is probably a good lesson for us.
Had a bit of a sensory.
The only other comment I'll make is regarding NATO and Finland is we now NATO and Russia have doubled their international border as a consequence of Finland deciding they were a little concerned about Russian aggression, decided they should join the alliance. So I personally am happy to see that military alliance expanding.
Yeah, we got Finland and Norway, but Sweden is still an outlander. So I guess there's some objections from a couple of NATO members, Hungary for one. We'll see how that all pans out. With that, let's get into small talk. It's about 15 after the hour, 14 after the hour, we'll talk to our guest, Marcy, and we'll talk about the Alliance for Tampatika Conservation, which goes by the short form, ALTO, rather than saying the Alliance for Tampatika Conservation every time.
Or Alliance Conservasi Tampatika.
Oh, yes, there you go. I'd have a lot of trouble with that one. I looked up your website, which is a beautiful website, and extraordinarily informative.
Thank you.
And the first thing that caught my attention was the mission. The mission is to help all of nature, including people, thrive. Its work is centered in Sulawesi, Indonesia, one of the Earth's most unique biological treasure houses. At the invitation of local communities, Aalto forges partnerships to protect and restore imperiled species, tropical rainforests, and other natural ecosystems while supporting the dignity and self-sufficiency of local communities in a changing world. Now, Marcy, let's just start out with you. Tell us a little bit about yourself, your relationship with Vashon, maybe how you came here.
Okay, sure.
Tell us about that.
Yeah, well, my family's roots are on Bainbridge Island, actually. But I moved to Vashon in the late 90s, which is only yesterday by Vashon standards. and I raised my kids here. But I do feel in many ways like very much a newcomer. It takes a long time to really get to know a place well. And I love the learning. So I feel extremely blessed to live here on this island with this unbelievably beautiful landscape and seascape and the people. I love the people here on the island. And yeah, I'm still learning how to inhabit it well.
Well, I don't want you to stop there. I want you to make me feel like a total underachiever. Tell me a little about your personal background.
I grew up on Bainbridge Island in Seattle and then went to the East for college, spent close to 20 years in the East. I studied comparative religion and art history in college, actually, although I knew that nature and animals was always my first love and that I wanted to come back to that as a career. So then I went up to Maine and spent some years in Maine, did a master's degree there in wildlife ecology and conservation, and then made my way back to the beloved Pacific Northwest. And I did not move to Bainbridge. I moved to Vashon.
Yeah, I mean, Bainbridge has a bridge.
Right. And what a difference that makes has made.
That's right. It does. Even though if you're going to the south end, you have to go all the way to the north end to get off the bridge.
Good.
I looked at your bio on your website, and I was quite impressed with your various accomplishments.
It came from a type A personality family. So
a bunch of overachievers.
Yeah, that sort of thing.
Well, tell us about, it's the Maleo?
Maleo, yes.
Yeah, us about the Maleo bird and how Vashon became associated with the Maleo bird, described as a national treasure in Indonesia. What's that all about?
Well, the story begins when in the early 2000s, I went with my kids to go. I'm a conservation biologist, and I went to go and work in Indonesia for a couple of years. And while I was there, I sort of stumbled across what I realized was one of the few remaining communal nesting grounds of this critically endangered bird called the Maleo. Now, the Maleo is this really cool, very unusual bird. It's actually been ranked as the 19th most important bird for conservation on the planet because it's not only endangered, but it's also evolutionarily entirely distinct. And this Maleo bird, the adult birds, it's about the size of a chicken, and it's very striking black and white and pink plumage. And the adult birds live in the tropical rainforest, but they nest in these nesting grounds, which are usually on beaches. And so when the adults are ready to lay an egg, they walk to a beach, to one of these nesting grounds, and they spend hours, sometimes days, digging a hole. Now, this bird is the original alternative energy bird. So, I mean, we got nothing on this bird. So the adults build a hole. They dig a hole in the sand about a meter deep, and they lay one enormous egg at the bottom of that hole. And then they cover it up with the sand, and they go away again. And the egg is incubated by the warmth of the sun or if there's geothermal energy in the area by geothermal heat. So they have figured out that this is how they're going to make their life on this planet. And they only live on the island of Sulawesi, nowhere else in the world. But they, in this way, at the time of the early explorer, Alfred Russell Wallace, who in the mid-1850s was one of the, he was a contemporary of Charles Darwin's, and he did a wonderful, very informative journey down through that part of the world and wrote about it. So we know a lot about what, and he actually also developed the theory of evolution at the same time as Darwin parallel. Anyway, they came to the same conclusion. But one of the ways that he did that was looking at the Malayo bird. And so the Malayo at that time was incredibly numerous using alternative energy. They were, Wallace described beaches as black with Malayo birds because they were so numerous. But since that time, unfortunately, largely because of over-harvest of the eggs by humans, Malayos have dwindled and dwindled and dwindled, and they're now very nearly extinct, critically endangered.
So, you know, I on your website, you have pictures of the Malayo bird, of course, and the egg.
Yeah,
That's a miracle right there.
It's
that is a big egg for a very not big bird. I mean, this is it's almost like an ostrich size egg.
I'm telling you, for females out there who have ever given birth, and you look at the size of that bird, and you look at the size of the egg that comes out of it.
It's unbelievable.
I'll tell you, yeah, you know, it gives you pause. So when I was living and working in Indonesia, I came across this nesting ground for the Malayo bird, and I had been asked to talk with locals, and I was getting to know the locals there in that area a little bit. And as we started discussing this bird, what the upshot of it was that they hadn't really realized that it was so special and so endangered. And they asked if I would help figure out a way to conserve it because they did realize that it was going down.
You know, before we went on the air, I mentioned the fact that I lived in Mauritius, which is about 4,000 miles to the west of Sulawesi. And they didn't have nearly the luck. They had the famous dodo bird that was wiped out after the Portuguese and the Dutch came to the island way back when. The dodo, of course, was a flightless, large, fleshy bird who laid eggs, and everything was pretty easy there. And they were wiped out rather quickly after civilization got to the island. How are you going to help save the Malayo bird?
Well, nature saved the Malayo bird.
Ah.
So
how are you going to help nature save the Malayo bird?
So what happened was that invitation, that request by local people to me to help them figure out something was the beginning of a series of conversations. And so I just thought I would, you know, talk with them a few times and we'd see. Well, then it turned out that I moved back home to Vashon and I continued to have a few trips there talking with local people. And I'd been asked to give a presentation on Indonesia's wildlife at Vashon Audubon one day, and this was about 2005. And so I did that, and at the end of that presentation, I said, oh, and by the way, you know, there is this local remote area of the island of Sulawesi, and they've got this bird called the Malayo bird, and they have asked for help to figure out a way to prevent the extinction of this really cool Malayo bird. So if anybody wants to get involved in that, you know, let me know. Well, this is Vashon Island. And after that presentation, a whole bunch of people came up to me, notably Yvonne Cooperberg, Ellen Kritzman, Jack Barbash, Oz Osborne, Raina Holtz. A lot of these folks came together and we just started talking. How could we help? How could we help these folks? And it was just the beginning of a very organic people-to-people kind of project where You know, you got Vashon energy and love of nature behind it. You had these folks in Indonesia who had a lot of desire to figure out something and to partner with some folks from the international community and figure out what could be, what we could do together. And that was the beginning of it.
You got some big names on Vashon in the environmental and ecological arena, for sure. And it's it doesn't surprise me those individuals jumped on board, but you're very lucky to have those individuals join the organization to help nature, help this bird. How many miles away is this?
Oh,
do you know?
About 12,000.
Yeah, I think so.
Yeah. We're extremely lucky. We have a wonderful board, and it has been a very, very much a partnership from the get-go. It began here on Vashon Island, and it's grown since then. And we also have board members from off-island and from elsewhere in the international community. And we have an Indonesian board. And it's very much a partnership. It's people, local people in Sulawesi, in Tompatika, who care about this bird, who are partnered with and supported by people beyond Tompatika in other parts of Indonesia and in other parts of the world who also care about the bird, the Maleo, and nature, and about how we can find ways working together to heal our planet.
And what can you do?
Well, the wonderful thing about this was that what we realized was nature will do most of it if you get out of her way. And what we learned was that the big killer threat to the Maleo bird was the taking of eggs by humans. So the bird has actually been declining, in steep decline, for quite some time, and it's been protected under Indonesian and international laws for decades. But those laws have never been observed or enforced. And so all we really needed to do was to basically sit down together in the community and remind ourselves about why we love this bird and why it was worth saving and why those laws protecting it had been put there in the first place. So it's illegal to take the eggs, and previously those laws were never observed. But once local folks realized that, I guess maybe we should stop taking the eggs. Maybe that was a good idea to have that law in the first place. Once people realized, they decided to, okay, let's stop taking the eggs. And we, as the international partners, were able to help facilitate that happening. So we basically hired the same people who used to poach those eggs as guards for the nesting ground. Mm. And all we really had to do was give them jobs to do something else instead of taking the eggs. And they actually got a better take-home salary by, being a guard than selling the eggs. And that allowed them to stop taking eggs. It allowed the birds to simply recover. All we had to do was end the poaching, protect the habitat, and nature did the rest.
Do you have any metrics on how they're recovering? I mean, like on Vashon, we have the bird count. What about in Sulawesi?
Absolutely. And that's been so wonderful. The poaching stopped in 2006. And we've been there every day, guarding the nesting ground and monitoring, counting the birds. And since we started taking data in 2006, the number of Maleos coming to the nesting ground to nest has sevenfold increased.
Wow.
So they have completely recovered. They're still increasing. And this has become the world's premier, healthiest nesting ground for this bird. And it's been an incredibly rewarding opportunity for the local people there who are facilitating all of this, making it happen, for us partnering with them and helping, and then people elsewhere in Sulawesi now. This is the part that's been so exciting, is not only have the Malayos recovered and thrived there at that first nesting ground, we now have two additional nesting grounds where we've done the same thing with other villagers in other places. And those have recovered fourfold in these other places. In other parts of Sulawesi, where people may have places where there are still a few Malayos left and they haven't quite disappeared, they're getting inspired by this and they're coming to visit our site and saying, how can we do what you did? We don't want to lose our Malayos in our place either. And it's just been such a wonderful thing to be part of as people realize, if we respect nature and get ourselves out of the way, nature can heal. And that's just been a wonderful thing to be part of.
It must be extraordinarily gratifying, because so often attempts along these lines don't take years. They take decades, right, and millennia. You're getting results quickly by the work you're doing. Just unbelievable. Let me ask you, are there other species or other living things that you're working on down there?
Yes. We try to work with sort of the low-hanging fruit, if you like, the things that are important to local people and the things where we know we can make a difference. And another critter along those lines that became very clear was in that category were sea turtles. Sea turtles tend to nest on the same beaches where Malayos are nesting. And we were already there. This was another situation where the big killer threat to sea turtles was poaching of their eggs and sometimes of the adult sea turtles. And so, again, same villages, same peoples. We started working with local villagers to conserve sea turtles. That takes longer because sea turtles can take about 20 years to reach sexual maturity. Mm. So if you start protecting the eggs, it's going to take you 20 years before those eggs grow up and come back to nest again. But we're there for the long haul. So that's been a really great thing to be involved in and helps us have a little finger of healing, as we like to think of it, in the marine environment. So it's not only terrestrial. We also work with bats, who are nature's wonderful rainforest maintainers.
Are these big bats?
Big bats, flying foxes, mm-hmm, fruit bats. And in fact, we... in one of our villages, right offshore, there is an uninhabited island that we now have managed to gain full protection for, and we have a conservation lease on it. And tens of thousands of fruit bats roost there during the day, every day. And then at night, they wake up and they fly above your head. If you're standing on that beach of the island, you see this river of bats over your head, and this is the bats and their daily migration from the island to the mainland, where they will spread all out for many miles, and they will pollinate the rainforest trees. They will spread seeds. They will spread fertilizer when they poop, and they're essential for keeping tropical rainforests healthy. And then when they've done that all night long, they go back to the island at dawn and rest there again for the day. So we've managed to protect that.
Bat guano, forests. Yes.
Yeah, bat guano.
That's right.
So,
Kevin, you had a question or a comment.
Yeah, well, I wanted to just mention that I had hoped to see some of the type of display that Marcy just mentioned with these bats on one of the few trips that I've had a chance to take to Sydney, Australia. Apparently, it's not far out of the city that there's a large forest, which apparently the bats do habitate. Unfortunately, when I was there, for some reason, they were not making that kind of a display. Maybe Bruce, you've had a chance to see them, but I've seen the little bats flying around here, you know, darting, just really like sparrow sized. But yeah, the bats that you're talking about are pretty phenomenal.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. They're big and over your head. You had something to say, Bruce?
I mean, I had a question for you. I mean, like Kevin said, I work some in Melbourne, Australia, where there's large colonies of fruit bats. flying foxes, and one of the problems was getting the farmers and the fruit growers, to sort of cooperate with the preservation of these animals. And I had the same question about the mellow and the eggs. And the turtles, they're great food sources. So how have people replaced those food sources? And, that's sort of the secondary consequences of this kind of stuff. Can you speak a little bit about that?
Sure. Yeah. So with the Maleo is not really needed for subsistence. It has been for quite a long time a luxury item, sort of like caviar. And so local people, for the most part, were selling the eggs for cash as a luxury item. And, they'd say, I'm going to send this egg to the city because there people want some special luxury present they can take to their cousin in Jakarta. And so we'll sell them a Maleo egg for that. So in the case of the Maleo, again, it really isn't needed for subsistence. It's a luxury item. And as I mentioned earlier, local people are now getting much more income by being paid as guards than they would have gotten by selling the maybe one or two Maleo eggs that were left before it almost went extinct. So that's really part of the what makes it all pencil out. But I've also been really humbled, Bruce, by how, we come in, very few of us have the experience of not having enough to eat, whereas a lot of those folks down there do know what that's like. But I've been very, very humbled by how often local people down there will tell me, I don't have to eat turtle eggs, I can eat chicken eggs. And they're very, when you remind them of what they love, then they get to decide whether that's something they need to eat or they don't need to eat. And over again, it's local people who have made the choice to say, no, it's worth it to us. We'd rather have Maleos and sea turtles and not eat them than eat them and have them go extinct. They make that choice themselves.
That's that could open up a lengthy discussion about the difference in cultures. My experience in that neck of the woods is the people have a tendency to be a little less egocentric and a little more ectocentric, thinking about their neighbors, perhaps more than they think about themselves, which is a good environment to do that. And that technique of making the individuals guards, that's the same kind of thing they use in Africa to protect the big seven and some of the large animals there. Bruce, were you going to say something?
Yeah, well, I had another question for Marcy about, you mentioned Wallace and his role. He's an interesting guy, but could you tell our readers and listeners, some of us are probably reading it, but the listeners, a little bit about the Wallace line and its significance and how that eastern part of Indonesia, New Guinea, Australia, New Zealand are biologically distinct.
Oh, thanks for asking that, Bruce. I love to talk about this. So if you're a nature nerd, like lots of us here on Vashon Island are, and you like critters, the Wallace line is Wallace realized that to the west of Sulawesi, Borneo, Sumatra, Java, the flora and fauna that he saw there were very different from those to the east, where, New Guinea, Australia. So in the east, you have marsupials, and and in the west, you have primates. And Sulawesi, what's part of what's called now Wallacea in his honor, is a transition zone. So what's really remarkable about Sulawesi is that it was never connected to a continental landmass. Everything on Sulawesi was like a little oceanic fragment that got there and bumped together to create this island. And as a result, it's got this weird mixture of marsupials and primates and weird stuff that just doesn't occur anywhere else, like Maleo birds. So the Wallace line is this biogeographical line that helps us understand where flora and fauna come from. And in Sulawesi, part of what I love about working there is that it is just so completely unique. There's the critters themselves, the species themselves that you see there, you know, like flying lizards and like dwarf buffaloes and like weird deer pigs and Malayo birds. Those species are entirely unique, and the communities that they make up are just weird, just like Vashon. So, you know, it was perfect for us to partner with folks in Sulawesi.
That is perfect, isn't it? Speaking of which, I want to just open up a topic that we could spend several hours on. You're commenting on the on some of the commonalities between Vashon and Sulawesi. My question is, Sulawesi, as you pointed out, was many thousands of miles away from us in the eastern and southern hemisphere. Why should the people of Vashon really care about that little corner of the Indonesian area? What does Tampatika have to do with us here on Vashon, and why should we care? That brings up that whole issue of the mining that's going on.
Yeah. So when I've been asked that question up until about 2-3 years ago, I had one answer, which was that we should care because, well, some of us think the critters are really cool. And that's great. But I've had people also who say, I don't care about a bird, you know, it's far away and all that. But what we need to realize is that we are already connected to Tampatika in ways that you may not realize. And up until 2-3 years ago, I used to talk about oil palm. I used to talk about seafood. And those things are all very direct ways that our consumption here is connected to Tampatika, namely is driving the destruction of places like Tampatika. Now there is a new 600-pound gorilla in that room, which is nickel. And one of the things we do, we work with species, of course, but a huge part of our work is also just protecting tropical forests. And that is increasingly a bigger and bigger part of our work. And right now, Tampatika, the big threat to tropical forests and communities in Tampatika is mining for nickel. And the big driver of mining for nickel is electric car vehicle batteries. And so here we are in this very complex and interdependent world. And in a very, very real and direct way, the consumption that we in the global consumer class are doing, even when we mean so well and we're trying to do, quote, the right thing by switching to an electric vehicle instead of a gas-powered vehicle, what we need to realize is that that consumption is still driving terrible devastation in places like Tampatika. It's very direct because in this particular case, most electric cars require quite a lot of nickel for their batteries. Most of the world's nickel comes from Indonesia. Most of Indonesia's nickel comes from Sulawesi. So we are now facing, the Malayo bird is facing, the communities that we are working with are facing potential complete destruction of the rainforest in the center of Tampatika and the communities that surround it for mining for nickel, which is being driven by the demand for electric vehicles. So it's this tremendous irony that we're all faced with, and it's so dismaying. You know, you're trying to find a way to inhabit this planet in a healthy way for everybody, and what do you do? And I think we have to just start with humility and realize that there is no free lunch, and everything we consume has a cost to somebody somewhere. And one of the gifts of for us in working in Tampatika is that it makes that very real for us, what that is looking like and what our consumption here in this part of the world in the global consumer class is driving in other parts of the world.
Kevin.
Yeah. So, yeah, Marcy, I did want to ask you, given that complexity that you refer to and those tough choices, what recommendations do you think our listeners should consider in, you know, addressing this, what we hear is this existential threat of climate crisis, which will threaten many, many species, and the very real concern expressed by nickel mining in Sulawesi?
Yeah. Well, I'm glad you asked that, Kevin. Thank you. We've thought about it a lot. And of course, there's a lot. You can read a lot about the nickel pickle, as it's called. And there are lots of calculations about, you know, the overall carbon footprint and whatever. And it's perfectly true that in the long term, electric vehicles have a lower carbon footprint than conventional vehicles. That is absolutely true. But the upfront footprint for electric vehicles is higher. Creating the car and producing the battery causes a whole lot of destruction and carbon in the short term. And what usually isn't in those calculations is it's not just about carbon. It's also about biodiversity. It's about the health of local communities that get poisoned by the toxins that are produced by nickel minings or the flooding or the air pollution and all of that. So for us, watching that in very specific terms in the local communities that we're working with and in, you know, with the biodiversity, like the Malayo bird, whose very existence is on the edge about this. So we're trying to sort of look at all of those things. And one of our board members, Dr. Cliff Rice, has done a lot of work on this, trying to say, okay, so what's a body supposed to do? Here's what we think. First of all, we think that if you can simply delay, reduce your driving, whatever it is you're driving, drive it less. Give yourself a mileage budget. Figure out how much you drive typically in a month, then slash that by 25% or 33%, whatever you can do. And drive less, whatever you're driving. That's a good place to start. Right there. We all did this for COVID. We know we can do this. Right there. Start there. So drive less. Secondly, if you're thinking about buying an electric car, wait. Wait a couple of years. Because one of the things that is going on is that they are developing new battery technologies which are less nickel intensive and less intensive in some of the really destructive mining things. What we're trying to do in Tompotika is right now, it's like a gold rush there. Everybody is coming. There's illegal mines because this surge in demand is so profound and dramatic. Everybody and his brother is coming to Sulawesi to try to mine nickel. And it's causing tremendous destruction. And we're trying to sort of work on the ground there to try to protect the most vulnerable areas, to try to identify some no-go zones, and to try to improve the practices, the mining practices in the places that do have mines so that they won't be as destructive as they have been when it's sort of anarchy. So we're trying to do that on that end. And what folks can do here is, you know, we've all heard it before, but drive less. And if you can delay your purchase of an electric vehicle, do that. We need to prioritize public transportation and other types of electrification of the transportation sector that are more important than our personal cars.
Yeah, Kevin. You know, this reminds me of a Riptide article that I read probably now 5 or 6 years ago, and it was really well done. And it basically said, you know, like, here's a week in the life of a typical Vashon Islander. You know, I was off to do a project in the garage, and oh, that ran out of paint. I'll just take a trip up to town, get another bucket of paint, right? And then 2 days later, oh, we don't have eggs. I'll just take a trip up to town and buy a dozen eggs. And then, you know, a day after that, you get the idea. So, yes, there are ways. So appreciate you pointing that out.
Yeah.
We needed to devote an entire show to that particular issue, amongst others. But that whole EV versus, you know, internal combustion engine, nickel use, et cetera, that really deserves a lot of thought and discussion. But in that, in those few minutes that you just talked about it, you threw a lot of light on the problem. Marcy Summers, if somebody wants to get more involved or might want to donate anything to your organization, how should they go about doing that?
Oh, thanks for asking. We do have a website. It's called tompotika.org, T-O-M-P-O-T-I-K-A, tompotika.org. Of course, we would love to take your money. Another thing, actually, that we could use right away, a very practical thing, if there are islanders out there, later this month, we have some visitors from Indonesia coming, and we could, if somebody wants to host a couple of them for meals, for a couple of, even just have them over for dinner, they would love that. We would love that. That's a way that you could get involved and learn from these visitors also speak English, so you could talk with them directly about what it's like.
And can people who might want to volunteer, can they get a hold of somebody in your organization via the website?
Yep, they can contact us via the website, or they can, you could send me an email, Marcy, M-A-R-C-Y, at tompotika.org. Just let us know. And often there are volunteer things to be done. So thank you for that.
Well, thank you for joining us today. And I encourage you to remain with us for the last 9 or so minutes.
I'd love to.
Yeah, good. Thank you very, very much. That was enlightening. We love the work you do. It's tremendous work. And the fellow Vashonites, as well as the entire organization that is doing such fabulous, fabulous work.
Vashon is a wonder in so many ways. And people in Sulawesi know it now, too. And so we should all be really proud of that.
That's great.
I'm very happy to be part of this island.
All right. Tell us, Kevin or Bruce, what's going on in the nation today? if you haven't been unconscious for the last few weeks, you realize that our ex-president is being arraigned as we speak, I think. I think Kevin has been multitasking as well as Bruce. Go ahead.
I don't know, Bruce. I know I've been paying attention. I definitely wanted to volunteer as arraignment watch duty, but I think we can multitask here as well. So just a few items that I picked up so far. Apparently, the Trump campaign is now fundraising off of a fake mugshot T-shirt. So in the event that, you know, maybe the real thing will emerge. But so far, I think the district attorney was thinking that that would be kind of the circus effect of this kind of a trial. So I don't know that they're going to do an official mugshot, but that did not deter our friends at the Trump campaign. Today, let's see. So Bragg and Trump are now both in the courtroom. Photos are starting to emerge. I will say he is not smiling in the photos that I've seen so far, but that might not surprise us. And just to keep the timeline, they're running about 15 minutes late. So the 2:15 arraignment is they actually arrived at the courtroom about 2:30 East Coast time. And the Trump lawyers say they're planning to ask for a brief recess, to review the charges once they're unsealed. So that's what I've got on my docket right now.
Have the charges been unsealed yet for the public?
I don't see evidence of that at this point. But, Trump pleads not guilty to 34 counts of falsifying business records and conspiracy. So I was really sort of hoping the conspiracy thing would find its way into the charges. Apparently that has now occurred, but I'd have to read the article.
Okay, so we don't know how many of these are felonies.
Carry on, and then maybe we'll do some reading while...
You know, I heard an interesting take on all of this. A fairly well informed and educated individual I know said, "We really don't want Trump to go to jail for a while." For those of us who are of the capital D Democratic or progressive. Side of the equation. The thought strategically was that he should run in order to help split the Republican Party. if he was precluded from running, they might have a less controversial candidate who could take it all. Thoughts? Go ahead, Kevin.
I'm just written for Liz Cheney to run as an independent for the 2024 presidential seat.
She's considering that, is she not?
Well, you know, I haven't heard a declaration, although maybe some have. What I do know that she was asked some months ago whether she would consider it. And her reply to that at that time was she repeated her mantra is she will do everything in her power to assure the former president does not get access to the Oval Office again.
Hmm.
So we're left to speculate.
Bruce.
It is a historic moment. When you're living in historic moments, it's hard to realize the significance of them sometimes because that comes down the road. But I was interested, Marcy, you've been back and forth to Tampico, and particularly over the last 5-6 years. I mean, what do they think of Trump? What do they think of American politics? Do they think we've gone crazy?
Well, first of all, they don't pay as much attention as we might like to think they do.
Right.
They're not Europeans after all.
They don't have the internet. Most of them don't have television. You know, they have a healthy focus on their own lives. Having said that, they think Trump is a goofball. You know,
I wonder why,
you can imagine. But one of the things that's been instructive to me is that when I've been down there, when Trump was elected, I was in Indonesia in 2016 when he was elected. And I, you know, burst into tears and, was really hard. And people just sort of thought, it's just politics. They're just politicians. Be here now. And that has been a healthy thing for me not to get. We all know that it does matter a lot, but it also is important for us to focus on where we are and what's before us. And so my Indonesian colleagues have been a real help in that. They're sort of like, that American Trump guy, whatever.
Yeah, that is healthy. You're right. Kevin.
Yeah, I just want to say just a couple more things. We'll see what eventually happens as the day progresses. But one unfortunate thing in this, and this is a little tongue in cheek, it seems the Manhattan District Attorney will not detain the former president in custody because he's apparently judged to not be a flight risk, to which I say, oh, darn. But that's just another opinion.
Well, you know, it's interesting. If there will be any restrictions, they might take custody of his passport. But it'd be difficult for him to sneak out of the country.
But the other thing I'd like to say is that, you know, you're going to hear about this unprecedented, political prosecution. And I'll just say a couple things. I think that us as a country, we've now put behind us this reluctance to hold a former U.S. president accountable under the law. I believe that's a healthy perspective to have. If you break the law, you should be held accountable to the law. And this claim, a rightful claim of unprecedented prosecution, in my view, is merely an appropriate response to unprecedented criminality from a quarter that we haven't seen in the past. So, of course, we will see. Presumed innocence until the jury speaks. But right now, I think that it's a very appropriate thing to put behind us this notion that we can't hold the highest in office accountable. We certainly can, and it looks like we will.
I agree 100%. People talk about, whether it was appropriate or not for the New York prosecutor to bring this action. A lot of discussion about that. I think the real discussion is why haven't the other two or three or four actions been brought by now? Because, again, there should be consequences. People should be held to account for their activities. And I'll be curious about some of the motions we're going to be seeing here. There'll be a motion to change venue the change where the trial takes place. Good luck on that one. They might want to move it to a community that might be a little more sympathetic, so the chances of getting a juror who might acquit would go up, but I don't know about that one. The other one is, I'm wondering what we're going to run into in terms of restrictions on the ex-president's speaking outside the courtroom. I think you're going to see that gradually ratcheting up over the next couple of weeks and months as necessary. You know, on that note, I'm going to tell you about next week. Next week, a Small Talks guest is Ben Hunter, the artistic director of Northwest Folklife, an organization near and dear to me. He's going to talk about the upcoming Folklife Festival, which occurs on Memorial Day weekend, and all of the year-round events of Folklife and the activities of Vashonites who are involved in Folklife. So for Marcy Truman, who's not with us, but you might be listening in, Kevin, Bruce, I'm Craig Bellis. Hope you will join us next Tuesday for the next edition of The Brown Briefly. Goodbye to
all. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you so much. Thanks.